Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Anoush.
And I'm Stephen.
And this week we're talking about...
the Spring Statement.
Russia.
And whether or not Vince Cable was right to say Brexit was the product of white nostalgia. As we record, Theresa May is yet to make her statement about the very, very serious measures she will take against Russia. But because... candidly, full disclosure, unless you've been holding out on me, Anoush, neither of us, I think, are going to pretend that we are Russia experts. I thought it would probably be more useful for us to talk about what we think the political fallout here will be to any kind of ratcheting up of diplomatic tensions with Russia as a result of, I can't believe I'm about to praise you this, because, I mean, if you are somehow listening to the New Statesman podcast, but you've missed this story about a spy, a former spy, being attacked with a nerve agent in Salisbury. The spy had been moved in a swap deal. He and his daughter are in critical condition. 21 other people have also got to go to hospital. It may be that 500 other people in Salisbury are going to suffer some kind of effect. The gas is one which is being manufactured in a lab, so it pretty much rules out the idea that it's not by a state actor. Have I missed any of the other crucial...
They've also worked out what type of nerve agent it is, and it's called Novichok. Sorry about the pronunciation. And it's something that was invented in the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
In the 80s, I think.
In the 70s and 80s is when this group of new nerve gases was working. So,
but if you haven't heard that, probably don't carry on listening to the New Statesman podcast and go and catch up.
Yeah, and well done. Or subscribe to my free morning email.
So we will know by the time this podcast goes out what Theresa May says. But some of the things that have been on the cards have been sort of more stringent sanctions, visa bans, potentially getting rid of Russia Today, or having RT, as it's now known, or having some kind of ruling on its activities and where it's broadcast. And those are already you talk about the diplomatic fallout, already those kind of strategies are dividing people in parliament, and not just across party lines, but in inter-party as well, because each party has its own MPs who have happily appeared on RT and who have a friendlier outlook towards Russia. And then both parties also have people who think it's repugnant to even appear on the programme. So it's interesting the way that it divides politicians.
Yeah. I mean, I know I just said we weren't going to opine on the actual sort of foreign policy issue, because neither of us are Russia experts. However, I'm going to break that rule immediately and go, I do think it is counterproductive to ban it, because you are then... ultimately, no one watches it, right?
Yeah, it's got a tiny audience,
I myself wouldn't appear on it, but I think then actually, like, that is the right place to be, whereas banning it will invite and allow reciprocal action against British journalists working in Russia.
Yeah.
So it doesn't seem like a very smart move to me if that is one of the things which ends up being considered. I mean, I think in terms of kind of the politics of it, obviously, once again, we are having a round of Seamus Milne's various comment pieces being re-aired Jeremy Corbyn's opinions about Georgia and the role of NATO being brought to light. What do you think the political effect of that will likely be?
I mean, as everyone already knows, Jeremy Corbyn in his career as a backbencher had appeared on RT, for example, and written opinion pieces that were less hostile to Russia than maybe the party line at the time. People already know this. And him and his advisors, particularly Seamus Milne, have the right-wing press and the Conservative Party and people in the Labour Party who are Corbyn sceptic have already tried to stick those kind of accusations on them. Whether you like it or not, it hasn't really had that much effect on the electorate's view of Jeremy Corbyn, I don't think. As we can see with all sorts of things that he's been tied to, it doesn't really have that much of an effect on the polls or people's opinion of him. It's already priced in. So I don't think that will have that much of an effect. And it's also inviting the counter-argument from the Labour Party, which is that there are Conservative MPs who have had very similar dealings with Russian media and also have similar opinions. And also there are donors to the Conservative Party who are rich Russians, which is something that Jeremy Corbyn was quick to point out.
Yeah, so the question I have, which I don't think anyone really knows the answer to, is we know that one of the reasons why, actually I think there are two important reasons why the foreign policy stuff has not landed on Corbyn. I mean, of course, it is true that Jeremy Corbyn would lead a Labour Party which would have a radically different approach to foreign policy than basically any Labour government we've had before. However, one, first and foremost, voters don't care that much about foreign policy. It's not a vote mover in any great numbers. But two, Corbyn is, I think, massively reaping the dividend of voter fatigue with interventionist foreign policy. Mm. Listeners to the Talking Politics podcast will go, I believe that Stephen Bush has stolen this opinion from Chris Brooke. Stephen Bush has stolen this opinion from Chris Brooke. What of it? But I think that is broadly the case, right? Then one of the things, you know, people got very angry when Corbyn did his big speech in the general election about, you know, these attacks are partly about our foreign policy.
Yeah, I remember, yeah.
But I can understand why, if you disagree with it, it makes you angry. I am still perplexed as to why people thought that was a bad... Yeah, people are, it's one thing to go, I'm angry about it, but those are opinions that, you know, if you've ever spoken to anyone normal, you know that there is a large constituency of opinion behind that. So I think there are two kind of, at the moment, there are sort of two factors that mean that Corbyn's foreign policy positions are not electorally vote moving in the way the Conservatives would like. The first is people don't care about foreign policy. The second is that Corbyn's foreign policy prescriptions are broadly popular.
Mm.
The question I have, though, is if we do end up in a situation in which we are in a real state of you know, diplomatic tension, perhaps ongoing cyber assaults from Britain to Russia, from Russia to Britain, you know, one or the other, or perhaps both, does that increase the salience of foreign policy, and does it do so in a way that Labour will find politically painful? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I think, as you say, because Jeremy Corbyn's view on foreign intervention is currently chimes with the mainstream, because we're still in the aftermath of an intervention that went wrong. He's in quite a good position, because if we do end up in that kind of cyber war or some kind of diplomatic debacle with Russia, Jeremy Corbyn can just go with what the popular opinion at the time would be, which would be, how did the government get us into this dangerous mess, for example? And I think, you know, the Conservatives trying to point out his sympathy towards Russia in the past, that hasn't worked in the past. So I don't think it would work now.
Yeah, I think, yeah, it feels to me that I could, of course, be comically wrong, but the problems that I think, if this does become a politically game-changing moment, I feel it is much more likely to be a disastrous moment for the government than the opposition. One, because this attack didn't come out of a clear blue sky. There has been a series of events which have led the Russian government to regard the United Kingdom as a fairly soft touch on them being able to do things like this. And of course, the variety of decisions, some within the control of the government, some not, have left the United Kingdom incredibly diplomatically isolated. Right. The thing I find, there are many things I find bizarre among the post-Cameron right, but I find it bizarre that there is a large group of people who can simultaneously hold in their mind that we must do absolutely everything to stop and prevent Vladimir Putin, but then Brexit, which the Kremlin believes and is not, you know, hiding, is a great foreign policy boon to them is somehow the best thing since sliced bread. It's just like, well, guys, you kind of have to pick one.
No, exactly. There are a lot of contradictions, particularly in, you know, even when people say, you know, we've got to be as tough as possible on Putin. Should we go to the World Cup? Oh, well, hang on. You know, it's never comprehensive. And also, I think that in terms of the Conservative Party losing out more from a war on some level with Russia, they are supposed to be the party of security. They're supposed to try and they're the ones who keep saying that Jeremy Corbyn's a terrorist sympathizer and is soft on security and terrorism. If they can't prove that they can deal with the situation, especially with Boris Johnson as foreign secretary, and we know that he's less and less popular and more and more of a joke, then they're going to look like they can't do the thing that people vote for conservatives to do.
Yeah, I think, so lots of people, particularly kind of various kind of people on the left have been saying things like, oh, you know, this is going to make her look strong, which I think contains a really interesting assumption, which is, I think, to look strong in any kind of diplomatic confrontation, you need to win.
Yeah, exactly.
Fundamentally, I cannot work out what winning looks like from a UK perspective. The UK is, A, diplomatically isolated because of what's gone on in the White House, and also because of our decision to leave the EU. As a net result of us leaving the EU will likely have a more dovish position towards Russia anyway. Because Russia is a managed democracy, to put it mildly, the level of voter fatigue that if we do end up in a situation where we have cyber attacks between the two states, that the Russian government can weather is obviously hugely greater than the level of voter resistance there will be, I think, if there is any form of cyber attack on any kind of British infrastructure. And also, as we saw in the election with police cuts, the fact that we are 8 years into fiscal retrenchment, our defence capability has been downgraded. We have a foreign policy which led to us being diplomatic. The government, I think, is quite badly exposed in terms of a negative scenario. Like,
really badly. Yeah. I mean, it's got its own defence ministers threatening to resign if they further cut the defence budget. It's in a really bad position. And Theresa May's already shown that she's weak on this already, what's already becoming a diplomatic disaster, because she gave the Russian government an ultimatum and they just ignored it. What's the point of giving an ultimatum when you know they're going to ignore it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and I don't want to kind of overly sort of run into the topic of the second half, which will, of course, be the spring statement. But there is this slightly weird thing that the modern-day Conservative Party just does have too many ideas that cannot be reconciled with one another, partly, I think, because of the leadership transition. But also, well, it feels, and weirdly, since 2017, they've done what defeated parties tend to do, which is to retreat into a closed and reassuring media and sort of commentator bubble, where they tell themselves that, you know, they lost votes because, you know, thousands of young voters believed Corbyn was going to write off tuition fee debt, which they just did not.
Yeah.
You know, certainly some shadow ministers did say that, but no one thought that that was what going to happen, right? It just was not a vote moving policy. But of course, they did not. Well, they didn't win. They didn't lose. They drew and they held on to Downing Street. So they're kind of doing the weird opposition behaviour while still being in office.
Yeah, licking. They're doing the thing, licking their wounds after losing an election by telling themselves the things they want to hear and not learning any lessons from it, which obviously Labour did.
Yeah,
the they're doing that now, except they're in government.
Yeah, it's kind of like they're basically doing the 2010 to 2015 Parliament.
Yeah, exactly.
But weirdly, they're in office.
Yeah.
So it'll be fascinating to see how that sort of works for them more broadly. But it does feel like a large chunk of the way people are talking about the politics of the Russia stuff is to forget that, A, Conservative policy decisions have made things worse. B, Jeremy Corbyn's isolationist, you know, let's have a dialogue, let's not get too hasty, broadly accords with where most people are. And I don't actually think I even had a third point. I just like list of three. however, on a semi-related note, you talked about cancelling British participation in the World Cup. So I was checking whether or not this has any effect on, this whole idea of you can't give him the propaganda victory. And so I went back, There was no boost to the government after a very successful 2012 Olympics. Yeah. No boost to the democratic government of Romano Prodi after Italy won Euro 2006. No boost to the Spanish government. No boost to the... I mean, so France 98 is a... 98, 96, can't remember. Whenever it was, the French government poisoned Ronaldo so Brazil would lose. I'm not even joking. I would be willing to bet, like literally, I 20 quid, the most money I ever bet on anything, that the French government poisoned Ronaldo before the 1998 World Cup final. Why was he so sluggish? But anyway, the point is that France is slightly more complex because at the time they were in cohabitation, the left and the right in government together. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to work out how you would detect a poll boost for the government. However, neither party seems to have done any better. So I do think this idea that like there's, you know, a vital section of the public in Russia who if England didn't turn up to be thoroughly indifferent and then go out to a relative minnow... is just nonsense. But what do you think?
Well, I think that I can understand. So I think there was a lot of talk about the poisoning happening now because of the elections coming up in Russia and also the World Cup. It's obviously been done to have the biggest impact on geopolitics. And so it would make a big statement, I think, if Britain didn't send its team to England, didn't send its team to the World Cup. But I can't say that I would mind very much either way, personally.
Yeah, I mean, I like club football, but I could stand not to have to. I mean, it's just, you know, if I want to be disappointed by the same...
Oh, God.
Sorry, if you've heard a large crash, listeners, the inexplicable map on our wall that you can see when we talk about the podcast on Facebook Live has just fallen off the wall and came very close to flattening Anoush.
I think that's a good note to end on.
Yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So this week, in good news for insomnia sufferers, Philip Hammond delivered the spring statement, the new pared down, not quite a budget. He has very sensibly, from policy perspective, scrapped the sort of full-fledged second fiscal event in the year. The budget is now in the autumn, and then basically right at the end of the tax year, so where we are now, the Chancellor will now do a kind of update if there is anything that urgently needs to be changed coming into the new tax year. Now, this is obviously good from a policy perspective. The United Kingdom's always been quite weird in having two big set pieces, but it does, I think at least, and maybe I'm just completely wrong and I've spent too long in Westminster, but I feel like it's a massive act of unilateral disarmament on the part of the government to abandon one of its major opportunities to set the narrative and to set discourse.
Definitely, because all it did was invite attention to quite bad financial figures without him saying anything about how he's going to try and ameliorate that, or to decide a policy direction, or to say anything at all in praise of his party's policies. So it kind of made the government vulnerable without giving them any chance to go on the attack or to be proactive, I think. But I don't know if that's necessarily Philip Hammond's fault entirely, because, like you say, the move to get rid of the spring budget, or what did it used to be called?
So it used to be a spring budget,
yeah,
and
the
autumn
statement. Yeah, to get rid of that is obviously more sensible. And there is this muscle memory in Westminster, particularly in the lobby, where it's like, well, we have to cover this as if it's the budget. So a lot of what wasn't in the speech was then, you know, reported on anyway, I suppose. So again, another difficulty for the Chancellor.
Yeah, so I agree with that up to a point. However, it is a much harder gig, and it does put away one of the government's pistols as far as their ability to kind of go, here's us, we're big and impressive, and to draw a dividing line with the opposition. However, even rhetorically, I didn't really understand what he was trying to do. Like, this whole, you know, the economy is great, there's light at the end of the tunnel. So basically, a little after lunchtime, Philip Hammond stood up and went, the economy's great, lights at the end of the tunnel. And then later that afternoon, he voted to reduce the eligibility for free school meals for some universal credit claimants. I think some people place too high a premium on the idea of like political argument and setting the terms of debate. And you know, this idea that if you have a big speech about, you know, the importance of capitalism, people will go, oh, right. Now you mentioned that capitalism is great. The fact that I haven't had a pay rise since the financial crisis and that inflation is hitting it still further seems like a good reason to re-elect the government. However, it does play a role. It clearly does affect how some people vote. I don't understand the politics of going light at the end of the tunnel. But by the way, there are still many, many, many more planned cuts coming down aforementioned tunnel.
I kind of understand why he does that. Because I think the Conservatives are quite good at getting away with saying austerity won't last forever, there's light at the end of tunnel. They've been saying that line since George Osborne in 2010, basically, in so many words, and people still vote for them. And the coverage in most of the mainstream newspapers is, oh, you know, if the Chancellor says I'm Tiggerish, the headline will be Chancellor says he's Tiggerish. He compared himself to Tigger for listeners who did not watch the statement. So I think that the Conservatives are so used to getting away with cutting budgets, making life more difficult for people, but saying that everything's going to be okay and actually they're being financially prudent and we shouldn't give in to the siren call of the Labour Party for more spending. I understand why they think that that works, because it has worked. The only problem now, as you often point out in your writing, Stephen, is that there's no more money to cut that people don't notice. So they've already hit disabled people hard, people on low incomes, people who claim benefits. And now the cuts just have to go further and further into the lives of people who have louder voices on these things.
So I think that is largely true. I guess where I part ways from you is I'm not sure that the rhetoric is quite the same. I feel that under Osborne, it was, it'll hurt, but it will be worth it. And the it being worth it was kind of in some nebulous future time. Whereas Hammond seems to have moved to a position of it hurt, but it was worth it, which in, to my ears at least, sounds as if the reward for austerity. Because I think one of the reasons why austerity is politically powerful is its political advocates say, this will hurt, but it'll be worth it. It immediately hurts. And that therefore proves that it will be worth it, right?
Okay, it's because there's truth in the statement.
If you promise pain and deliver it, right, you've kept your promise.
Yeah.
And also people are in any case cynical about politicians keeping their promises. And so the fact that the promise of austerity's pain is immediately delivered, I think, is one of the reasons why it's politically powerful. But it feels to me, and I'm both interested in what you think of this, and also let us know if you all also think that I'm completely writing up Cameron and Osborne too fairly. I feel that the difference is Hammond sounds like the pain is going to stop. It does sound like he's saying, like, we've had our bad times and the good times are about to roll.
Okay, because when I listened to Hammond's speech yesterday, I thought that he sounded a bit like George Osborne used to sound, but there is a subtle difference in the rhetoric. Saying there's light at the end of the tunnel suggests that the benefits of this austerity agenda are going to arrive in this parliament, I suppose. Yeah. It suggests that, which George Osborne never really did say, I don't think. But I do think that it does sound similar to me. It does sound like, come on, you've just got to grin and bear it for a few more years and then you'll see that we're really economically responsible and, you know, there's sunshine ahead. There's always this idea of light and sun. I remember George Osborne was always talking about the sun shining or fixing the roof while the sun's shining or these kind of things. And that hasn't borne out yet and it's going to be the same this time.
Yeah, because I think... And yeah, this is, I feel I probably said this last week and I'm slightly concerned that I'm starting to gradually develop into a Bond villain. But this is where the slight annoyance of the fact you can't run experiments on countries. Yeah. So we have no kind of control group. But my sort of assumption is that even if the Conservatives had the right rhetoric on austerity, it would be getting harder anyway, because as you say, the easy cuts, the cuts which affect Labour voters, the cuts which affect only people with acute need have been done, basically. You can see it in council satisfaction figures, which were really high for the first 5 years, because basically councils just had to keep their legal responsibilities and they cut a lot of really important but stuff which just did not touch the lives of most people.
Yeah.
And now just like the public realm just looks really tatty all the time.
It looks frayed at the edges.
And Yeah, I was at the press awards last night collecting my silver medal. You don't actually get a medal.
Congratulations. You get
a letter, and which I will, like Jose Mourinho, throw into the crowd. As happens on every journey I take, there was a man in a tent at Hyde Park Corner Station who I spoke to a little bit, and there were the same faces that I see sort of every day sleeping around Finsbury Park Station at the other end. And the thing I really notice is actually by the end of the New Labour period, yes, there were still people sleeping rough. I'm not remotely saying if, you know, like you commit a crime and are ostracised by your family, or you have like, you know, very profound mental health issues, you should end up on the streets. Obviously, you shouldn't. But the homelessness towards the end of the New Labour period was the most difficult homelessness to tackle. You still can tackle it, but it's not homelessness which you can simply go like, look, well, if we just put more money into here,
yeah,
less homelessness would automatically come out. Homelessness is now back at kind of, you know, it's late 80s peak. And I think it's a huge problem, both in terms of the consequences on the lives of people who are homeless. But I think it's a huge electoral problem for the government, actually, because it really frightens people, I think.
And it's very visible.
Yeah.
So you can't necessarily see cuts to women's refuges or mental health provision or disability benefits. You can't necessarily see them unless you're involved in that sector or you have someone who's affected by it. But you can, everyone who walks down a street can see homelessness.
Yeah.
So in terms of it being a reality and something tangible, it's probably the biggest thing that shows you that something's gone wrong in terms of government spending, because who is there to pick up the pieces? Charities that are underfunded, and also you shouldn't have to rely on charities, and the government's not doing it.
Yeah. And I think it, to me, speaks to some of the I do just think the Conservative Party is in such a fascinating psychological state at the moment. But then within the conservative mainstream, there's basically a position of a school of thought that's incredibly common, which is Brexit is a disastrous mistake. It's awful and terrifying that 12 million people have voted for Jeremy Corbyn. The policy agenda of the last 7 years has been broadly successful and right. And it's just like, well, how do you possibly reconcile those three things?
Yeah, and I think they're making so many excuses, particularly the Conservatives, who I assume you and I speak to more often, who are more pro-European,
yeah,
maybe thought of as to the left of the party. They love to say that, oh, you know, Brexit has caused this uncertainty, and so we don't have very much money, and that's why the party looks electorally worse, etc. But that's an excuse. Like, if you're not, you know, an example... There are so many Conservative MPs who talk the talk about how there's not enough public spending and then vote it through anyway. And I think they use sort of bashing the government on Brexit as an excuse not to actually challenge what the real problem is, which is their financial agenda.
Yeah, and there is this kind of... Yeah, and obviously we have a really skewed perspective, I think, on the Conservative Party, because I feel, I'm not sure if you have the same, but I feel like I find it fairly easy to talk to like the outer right,
yeah,
of the Tory party, because they... feel, and that's the same as being, you know, intellectually broad-minded, is to talk to people from the NS, and I appreciate it, of course. And then people from the left of the Conservative Party, and then the sort of Tory equivalent of the soft left, you know, it exists, but it's kind of like the political equivalent of dark matter, I feel, for us. But yeah, as you say, just like those people who you kind of go, but you've really got to, at some point, if you think these public spending decisions are bad, you have got to, you know, do something.
Yeah, you've got to actually do something about it and not use... It's almost like Brexit is... I know this is a ridiculous thing to say, but it's almost like it's a neutral issue somehow. Like, if you're a Tory MP who opposes Brexit, you can sort of use that to be one of the good guys without actually doing anything about austerity or making life difficult for the leadership. It reminds me a little bit of when Jeremy Corbyn was first elected as leader of the Labour Party, and there were lots of Labour MPs who opposed his leadership, and they would use him and his leadership as an excuse for why their party had lost the election. Do you remember? They just were like, this is our big problem, is Jeremy Corbyn, and he can't relate to the common man. And it's like, hang on.
Yeah, it's just like,
you've got this huge demographic problem.
Yeah, the guy didn't inherit and people will still occasionally talk as if like the Labour Party was this Rolls-Royce machine and was in government with this huge majority, and then on the 12th of September 2015, like Jeremy Corbyn somehow became leader of the opposition.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's still one of those things which is like, and she's like, no, guys, the election of Jeremy Corbyn is really, at the absolute most, you can say, a symptom of Labour's wider problem.
Yeah.
And it does, yeah, you're right, it is, I think, exactly the same. And now it's time for a section we like to call...
You Ask Us.
Indeed. So Vince Cable is under fire for referring to, well, saying the Brexit vote was caused by people who were nostalgic for a time when men were men, women, sorry, when passports were purple or blue, when the map was coloured an imperial pink, and where most faces were white. He's been reported for a hate crime by some angry Brexit person. And kind of the question we're sort of getting is, well, was he right to say it?
I think on Vince Cable's own terms, he was right to say it because he's been saying it for ages. Maybe it hasn't cut through because I don't think he's been a particularly successful leader of the Liberal Democrats, and his actual campaign to be leader wasn't very high profile either, because in the end he just ran unopposed. But I know because I went to interview him last year and I was researching him, and that is his view. He thinks that one of the main drivers of the vote to leave the European Union was racism. So on his own terms, I think he was right to say it because that's what he believes. And it is a sign of our sort of throwaway news culture that it caused such a huge row. I suppose he said it in a very stark way by saying people's faces were white, which is very...
Yeah, it was a bit... because your interview, which is very good and had several news lines in it, but I feel like that made hay and that wasn't the first time he'd said it either.
I don't think he'd said that. So the thing in my interview for listeners who didn't read it, you should still go back and read it, was that in Mein Kampf...
Oh, yeah.
Mein Kampf is similar to Theresa May's phrase, citizens of nowhere, in her speech to the Conservative Party conference before the election.
It was a good interview, even though
thank you
slagged off his flowers.
Yeah, listeners won't know that I did receive a letter of complaint from Vince Cable's wife after writing up my interview because I'd got the type of flowers wrong that were growing around an arch over his front gate.
Yeah.
Sorry, Mrs. C.
That's why people don't trust journalists. But so I think, yeah, the thing is, right, is any serious academic analysis of why people voted to leave does show that nostalgia for, you know, another time was a major driver, and concern over immigration, including, you know, immigration from places which are, you know, not likely to join the EU, like Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
I feel... Yeah, there have been a lot of things and political journalists have got wrong, but I feel confident in my prediction that Pakistan is not going to become a member state. That is certainly true. I think the one thing which is interesting is, you know, and I may just have been running the figures slightly wrong, but actually one of the mistakes I think people make when they read across from Trump to Brexit and vice versa is that it doesn't appear that there is a particularly strong racial or raced, I don't know which the correct adjective or form would be, dynamic to that nostalgia. If you were in favor of the death penalty and you were from the Indian subcontinent, you probably voted to leave. Ditto.
Mm-mm.
If you were there, whereas with Trump, yes, there was an authoritarian lean, but there was also a very strong racial lean on top of that.
Yeah.
But I mean, it is one of those things where it is factually just true, right? That was a big driver of the Brexit vote. And I think if the Lib Dems want to become a kind of UKIP of Remainers, you know, in which they seize most of the votes of the 15% of people in the country who are most angry we're leaving the European Union, I think it is the right approach.
I think that's a really good phrase. I was going to say something similar, the UKIP of Remainers, because that is what he's doing, not necessarily in terms of just picking up votes, but also in rhetoric. He's basically saying the crassest thing, the crassest analysis of the situation that he can to get that coverage and outrage and people saying that's not how you should word it, that's not nuanced, but then that prospect is out there and people are exploring it and debating it and it becomes part of the agenda. And I, for one, don't really want people to forget the sort of hate crimes that sprung up after Brexit, or the fact that there was like a spike in Islamophobic attacks last year. You know, someone's got to keep that sort of idea on the agenda and not be too sympathetic to people's legitimate concerns.
Ah, to use that fraught phrase. Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting question is, at the moment, it feels that the difficulty the Lib Dems have is the people like you and I, you know, kind of, you know, metropolitan elites or whatever, are kind of grateful to the existence of the Lib Dems sort of saying these things, but we are not on the whole rewarding that party with our votes.
Yes.
And so that is where I think the question of whether it was the right thing to do becomes more interesting, right? We know that basically half of the country has forgiven the Lib Dems for coalition, or is now saying they always thought it was the right idea, even though if you look at that same person talking to the same, because the wonderful thing about YouGov is because of their panel, you can see, so sometimes you have the thing where respondents will go like, oh, well, actually, I always thought the coalition was a guy. It's like, no, you didn't. But the point is, half of the country has forgiven them.
Yeah.
The difficulty is that there is no difference between that half of the country and the half of the country which hasn't, right? That half of the country, a third of them are angry Remainers, a third of them, yeah. So they look exactly like the other half. It's just that, which means that the problem, I think, is one, the Lib Dems are probably fishing in a smaller pool in terms of angry Remainers than they would necessarily want to be. The second isn't as long as Corbyn is leader, and I think this is one of those things which is specific to Corbyn and wouldn't pour over to any of the possible leaders of the Labour left, is he gives off a reassuring vibe to angry Remainers. I don't quite understand how he does this, because he's giving increasingly explicitly.
He's a Lieber.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things where it does feel like this weird philosophical question, right? If a man stands up and says something explicitly the reverse of what people believe it to be, and yet they choose to hear it the way, I mean,
he must be a brilliant politician.
Yeah, it's just like, I mean, well done him. But the question is at the moment, yeah, and in the election and so far, it feels to me Labour are doing a really good job of leveraging Jeremy's reputation and sort of social liberal bona fides in order to get away with having a Brexit position that is considerably tougher than a lot of those voters would like.
Yeah.
Now, I assume Jeremy Corbyn starts with quite a large bank of goodwill. I also assume it's not infinite, because no one's goodwill is. And so the question I have is, should the Lib Dems keep punching that bruise and basically hope that eventually the dam breaks and then suddenly they've shot up to 15%? Is it the kind of thing which only happens when Labour gets into office? I don't know.
Yeah, probably more likely the latter, because, yes, I've interviewed some EU citizens who, after Jeremy Corbyn made a comment about, you know, ending free movement, and lots of them said, look, I really don't like what he said about EU migrants, but I agree with all of the other values that he has. And I know that he's got a history of, you know, of sympathy to quite unfashionable causes like immigration and rights for migrants. So I don't think the Lib Dems are ever going to beat him on those values, because people still remember them being in government with the Conservatives. I know that there are voters who have forgiven them, but if the Lib Dems are going to try and copy or try and be like the good guys in terms of those kind of values and try and steal a march on Jeremy Corbyn, they're never going to. So I don't see it happening until Labour are in government and maybe Jeremy Corbyn's goodwill somehow runs out.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, my colleague Anusha Kellyan. It's recorded by India Bork and produced by Caroline Crampton. Our music is Devil by the Devil, licensed by Creative Commons. It's my birthday next week, so I shall be away. But the ideal birthday present would be for you to subscribe to The New Statesman in print and online.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.